Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm John Milford, Chair of the Club's Grown-Ups Forum and your host for today. We also welcome our listening audience and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Kira Reginato. As an elder care manager and consultant, Kira has served thousands of older adults and their families in a variety of settings: hospitals, residential care and skilled nursing facilities, hospices, Alzheimer's, adult day care programs, Meals on Wheels, and in her own firm, Living Ideas for Elders. Kira's three decades of expertise, as well as her warm personality and compassion, were enjoyed in two weekly radio shows focused on aging, The Elder Care Show and Call Kira About Aging. Kira is available for speaking engagements and enjoys public speaking and just published her first book, Tips for Helping Your Aging Parents Without Losing Your Mind. So, Kira, will you come tell us how to do that? Thank you.
So great to see you all here. Thank you for coming tonight. We're going to have some fun, and there's going to be some audience participation. I have a lot of really interesting things to tell you and to show you. The slide there, I hope everyone can read. I'm going to give you ideas for keeping your mind, your temper, and your sense of humor when you're caring for an older adult. And even though I graduated a long time ago from SF State with a degree in gerontology and know a lot academically and have helped many families, I got to take care of my own father for 2 years, which is how the tagline on the book was born, without losing your mind. Because I, too, even though I knew all about it academically and did it for a living, had to live it and spent 2 years caring for my own father. So throughout my book, I've woven little snippets about that. So I've walked the walk as well. How do you keep your mind? Well, that's interesting. There we go. In my mind, one of the best ways to keep your mind is to be organized. And how many of you right now are caring for an older adult? One, two, three, four, five. Okay, so about half of you. So probably you have been dealing with a lot of different situations with them and been putting in doctor's cards here and hospital discharge notes there, and things are probably not all together in one place. If you've already started to document what's going on so that you can refer to it later, good for you. And if you haven't yet started your caregiver journey and you can begin to keep things in one place, that's my suggestion. And in the book, what I actually say to do is to start a computer file on your loved one. So mine's just called Dad Notes and Mom Notes. And as things started to change, I suggest you start doing this when your parents are about 70, that you just start writing down little things that are going on with them, things that they mention. They had a root canal. They were dizzy and they fell. A hospitalization that they had. Any changes that come up, because inevitably when you're in the doctor's appointment with that person, the doctor's going to say, how long is this? When did this start? How long has this been going on? And your mom or dad is going to be like, I don't know, about a month ago. Well, you can look at your notes and know that actually you noticed it a year ago, and you can help inform the story. And one of the ways I like to help people get set up for what's going to happen down the line is called a hospital visit binder. What I'd like you to do is imagine that I've just had a stroke. I'm at my house. The emergency team arrives. They bring me to the hospital. What are they going to want to know about me as soon as I get in the door? what medications I'm taking. What else are they going to want to know? Allergies to medications, absolutely. Medical history, what's wrong with me? And who do they usually get this information from? If I just had a stroke and I'm not speaking, who are they going to want to contact? Power of attorney, daughter, son, they're going to want to know something. A lot of hospitals now have electronic medical records. So if they can know who I am when I walk in the door, if the EMTs have grabbed my wallet, if I have my insurance card or my ID, that's great. It's not always possible that you're going to arrive with that. So what I like to do is create this hospital visit information binder and actually put a note on the refrigerator that tells the EMTs that this exists, and I'm going to walk through it with you. One of the things, I don't know, have you guys seen the POLST form? This pink form? This is like a thumbnail sketch form that tells anybody what you want in terms of CPR, to be intubated for breathing, or artificial nutrition and hydration. And I'm not going to go into the form, but you're welcome to look at it afterwards. We suggest that you put a copy of that right in the beginning of the binder so that that emergency room staff could see at a glance exactly what I want done. Then you've got a divider labeled patient information. And that's where I had my dad's information, where he lives, how old he is, his Medicare number, next of kin, that sort of thing, his main doctor. The next is health insurance. They love, love, love to be paid. So they love a copy of the insurance card. So again, if they didn't grab my wallet, but I've got it here, copy of front and back. And all this information is in the book, by the way. Medications, you guys all mentioned that. Space for allergies, diagnoses, you mentioned what's wrong with me, what's my mental health history, what's my physical history, I've got all the problems listed, and lastly, legal. And with my dad's binder, I had his advanced health care form that he had filled out, and then power of attorney showing that if I showed up to the hospital and wanted to make decisions, that was already in the binder that I could legally do that. So I just call this the hospital visit binder. You can call it what you want. The most important thing is that your family knows where it is so they can grab it and bring it if they're called, or the EMTs know to grab it and bring it out with you because there's a little note. Typically, I don't know if you know, but EMTs are trained to look on the refrigerator or inside the refrigerator for your vial of life or for your do not resuscitate order. I guess everyone has a fridge, so that's what they decided a long time ago. If I were brought into the ER and I had my stroke, what am I going to be wearing? Could be nothing, right? Knowing me, could be my PJs. I might have socks on. I might not have socks on. So I love, in addition to your hospital visit binder, for you to pack a little backpack with clothing in it and with things you think you might want. And I just call it the grab and go bag, which is, these are the things that I have found when I go to a client's hospital room and they are in the hospital, things they're asking me for. So my dad loved me to get him for me to buy a payday candy bar. You got to have change to put a whole bunch of quarters in there, or nice flat ones. So in his grab-and-go bag, I had his extra glasses for reading. I had his crossword puzzles. I had a book. I had his cell phone charger. So any time I found out he was in the hospital, I could grab his grab-and-go bag, and it had all this crap in it. I had a client who was wanted her Merle Norman lipstick. I didn't even know where a Merle Norman was to buy it, but I couldn't buy any other lipstick. She was a millionaire, and she said, I want that, and I need a mirror. I said, okay, well, tell me where to go. So I had to find $35, go down, buy it, bring it back. But before the cardiologist came, she wanted to look good. I said, okay, that's important to her. And your grab-and-go bag next time, we're just going to keep it in there. The number one thing we don't remember is street clothes and shoes to go home in. You get a call, your dad's ready to be picked up. You go to get him, but if he came in his PJs and no shoes, that's how he's leaving. Or that's how he's being transferred to the next stop. So many times people are discharged and they're just in a hospital gown. So I remember I had a client who had moved from San Francisco General after a fall to a nursing facility, and when I visited her there, they gave me her two-week-old bloody nightgown. They said, here you go. We thought you might want this. I called the family. I'm like, how do you feel if we pitch this nightgown? They're like, absolutely. But I knew that when she left the nursing facility, I was going to need to have street clothes and shoes for her. So this is, again, all in the book, these things that you can do to put in the grab-and-go bag. If our goal is to keep our mind and avoid crises, the number one thing that I come across is falls, leading to a lot of unpleasant outcomes. How many of you here know someone who has fallen? Okay. And how many of you could say that it probably was, if you think back on it, the beginning of the end? Right? So I'm a big proponent of not falling, and I have fallen myself in a parking lot recently, and it's a long way down when you're an adult. So my whole thing is to avoid falling, and I have a few tips for that, for making your house safer and for things that you can do. In the book, there is actually a 23-question assessment that you can do. You walk through with the book open. You take the assessment of your home or your loved one's home, and then you go back through and make those adjustments after you've done the assessment. And that will save a lot of time and energy because you're probably not thinking about common fall risks that I have in the book. Number one thing, throw out your throw rugs. They look great, but I have had many clients fall on these. The edge or the backing loses its rubber, and because you paid $40, you don't want to throw it away. Then the person goes flying. So, and also tassels on the rug. I've had a couple of clients fall because their slipper got caught in the tassel of the rug. Now they went to India. They love this rug. They've had it in the living room for 100 years. They never gave it a second thought. You're 85. You have little mincing steps. Your vision changes. Your balance changes. I'm sorry, time to cut off the tassels or double stick the tape. We got to think of some safe way to prevent you from falling. So I actually, as a care manager, will go in and often ask permission to roll up the care rugs and take them with me. And if they'll allow me, I'll just buy new ones that have better rubber backing or convince them not to put them down at all. Step stools and ladders. Our balance changes as we get older. Big tip, one thing you can do to help with that to avoid falls is do a lot of ankle swivels and point and flex. Evidence-based tells us that that really helps those joints stay mobile, so if you start to fall, you can catch yourself. But what I suggest is not getting up on step stools or step ladders anymore. I have my daughter, frankly, change all of like the smoke detector batteries because it's going to be harder for me to heal. And if I break something, I'm going to have to go into the hospital, then to rehab, and then home with some home care. It's going to cost me a lot of money and a lot of time. She's 25. How long is it going to take her to heal, you know? I had a 94-year-old gentleman who was living independently and doing great, got on his step stool to get a can of soup for lunch, fell backwards, never lived alone again. So if you want to have these things, bring things down so that it's at an easier level or use one of those grabbers. Don't get up on a step stool or ladder. That's my 2 cents. Medicine bottles. So we know that medication errors cause a phenomenal amount of hospital admissions and emergency room visits. People take too much of their medication or they don't take enough of their medication or their medication interacts badly with another. So I'm suggesting that people get a system in place for taking their medications. People over 65 are typically on 6 to 12 medications. And if they're relying on opening and closing 6 to 12 bottles every single day, the chance of them making a mistake goes up. I like pouring medication into what we call a MediSet or a pill box. And I actually do this with my clients, or I have them do it so that there's two people doing it. So you pick up your medication, your Lasix, and you pour it for the whole week. And then you kind of have somebody double check. Do you see just one of those in there? Yeah. It's tough because the pills are white and a lot of these are white on the bottom. I think they should be like darker color so it's easier to see what's in there. But this cuts down the incidence of mistake. And if you only visit your loved one once a month, you can pour four of these. Put three up on the cabinet, pull one down. Mom or dad uses it for the week. You pull the next one down, etc. It's also easier to call on the phone and say, hey, Mom, did you take your noon medication today? It's Tuesday. And have her go over. Noon, Tuesday, open the red box. Is there anything in there, Mom? No, honey, it's empty. Great, she probably took it. It's just a little bit safer than relying on the bottles. My favorite are two new things they've come out with. The blister pack is not as new, but you may, if you ever have your loved one in a nursing facility, they give you this card and say, you can take this, this is what's left. Well, there's a couple of pharmacies that will fill your meds like this, and you just push out this foil and take what's there, and you can ask them to put all your meds in here. Not just, usually it's one card per med, but they can put in your medications in here, and then you can just look for the day, it's the 30th of whatever, 17th, push out the meds for the 17th and eat them. And you can have a morning, noon, and night card. The other is this really cool thing called a Medi strip that's like a roll of toilet paper. And this is where the medications are in here, and then it's labeled what day you're supposed to take it and what's contained inside of it, and you just tear it off, open it up, and you take the meds. So you take your morning, your noon, your night, however you're prescribed, it comes pre-rolled for you like this. And you can also have your over-the-counter meds in, so your vitamin D, your vitamin C, calcium, whatever you're taking, they can package all of it in the Medi strip. One of the things I ask people to do when they're with their parents at the doctor is ask for a brown bag. We call it a brown bag review or a medication review, in which the person takes all of their meds to the doctor, all the over-the-counter, and hands it to them and says, do I still need to be on all this crap? Because oftentimes your parent may be taking a medication that the doctor had on their list as being discontinued, and the parent is still taking it, or they have the generic and the name brand, and they're also taking both. So it's a really nice time to do this review and just say, is everything here needed still? If the answer is no, you're going to save money, going to save side effects, time refilling it, the whole nine yards. So that's a really good thing to do if you're with your parent or your loved one at a doctor appointment. We have something called the Beers criteria, which is a listing put out that shows medications that are counterindicated for people over 65. I don't know if you know, but when medications are tested through the FDA, it's for children and then just adults, so sort of 25, 30. They don't actually have to go through testing on 65-plus population to become approved. So we know that kidneys, excretion, you know, slows down as we age, digestion changes. So a medication might be staying in an older person's system a lot longer than it might be a 25-year-old person. So I like to basically realize that some people might be on medications that are going to cause a higher incidence of falling, and also look at the over-counter medications that might have a drowsiness effect. A lot of people might take Benadryl to sleep. They might take Tylenol PM. That all increases your fall risk, and that's on the Beers criteria for seniors not to take at all, frankly. And of course, a lot of seniors are drinking. So you've got medication on board that causes you to be drowsy, which might increase your fall risk, and then you're adding alcohol to it. So again, my whole thing is to try and prevent falls. Keeping your temper. Short term, I want to say that most of us are great taking care of someone. If Sana broke her leg and she said to me, hey, Kira, can you cook me meals Monday, Wednesday? I can't stand at the kitchen counter. Of course I can come over Monday and Wednesday and cook her dinner. No problem. If she said, could you come over to cook me dinner Monday and Wednesday for the rest of my life? I'm busy. I'm moving to Puerto Rico. I mean, this would be a hard thing for me to embrace fully that I'm going to. But that's how caregiving is. We agree to help these people, and it starts out probably occasional, and then little by little by little, it's taking up much more of your life. And you don't stop to say, what do I really have available in my life to do? What can I really manage? Gosh, I'm going through a divorce. My cat just died. I changed jobs. I sold my car. We have these lives of our own, and we're trying to help somebody else live theirs. It's very stressful, very easy to lose your temper, especially when something silly, in our opinion, comes up. There's also costs for being a caregiver. What do you think some of those costs might be to you if you're doing this work? Or that you're currently experiencing. Yeah, Sarah.
Lack of sleep.
Absolutely. So that's a physical take, right? A physical problem. Yeah.
Psychological well-being,
and that leads to
depression.
Anybody else feel isolated? Right? Like, you love your mom, but you're spending a lot of time there. I told my dad we were at dinner once, and it didn't go well. We were kind of grumping at each other, and he said, I'm really sorry that didn't go well. I said, I think we should start seeing other people. John, what do you have? What do you think a cost would be?
I'm thinking of travel. Your parents out of the area?
Absolutely, a financial cost. What I see is that adult children tend to put off their own health care needs. Anybody here not gone to their own doctor appointment or dental appointment? I had a sister-in-law get stage 4 cancer diagnosis because she missed her mammogram one time because she was busy running over from Danville to Petaluma to visit her 95-year-old mother in the nursing home. Skipped that one appointment. It was the only year she ever skipped it. Once her mother died, she got diagnosed and had to go through chemo. She's fine, but she was really angry that she had put her mother's welfare in front of her own. And I hear this all the time. Let me read you the financial cost. We're talking, there's the emotional cost, there's a physical cost, but there's also, MetLife did a study in 2011 showing that women who are caregiving lose $322,000 worth of income in their lifetime if they're caregivers. Men lose about $277,000 if they're caregivers, according to the study. And that's because they're figuring if you're not at work because you're taking mom to a doctor or you're flying out of town to pick up the pieces after a hospital stay, you're losing wages. You're not contributing to your pension. Social Security's not being taken out for your future, because you're not paying in those wages. So they're averaging that cost over a lifetime for a woman at $322,000, and $277,000 for a man. And I don't know how many of you guys are caring for someone over 50, but traditionally we're spending about $5,500 a year in incidental expenses for them. Oh, that's okay, Mom. I'll get these groceries. Oh, I'll get those medications. You're not keeping track. You're not getting reimbursed. So they're figuring that's over $5,000 a year. So if you're caring for somebody for 10 years out of the goodness of your heart, running back and forth, that's all money not going into your own savings account. So there's a huge financial cost that I don't think we really think about. There are parents. We love them. There are spouse. We're just doing what we're doing, but there is a cost. The good news is I just read in September that Deloitte, one of the big 4 financial accounting firms, decided its employee package will now include paid leave for all caregiving, including elder care, for 16 weeks. Yay, Deloitte. So hopefully we're going to see if people are trying to attract the best and the brightest employees that they're going to start offering us paid leave if we're taking care of older parents. And from what I understand, in employee assistance programs, elder care calls are outpacing child care now. So, and what I also want to say is just because you're smart, because I think of myself as smart, you guys are smart, we figure we can do this caregiving stuff on our own. And we don't tend to do as much resourcing or connecting about it with other people as we could. And I want to say that being smart is not congruous with dealing with an 82-year-old woman who has dementia. Those two things don't go together. You have to get the resources and the support to help you keep your mind, keep your temper, that kind of thing. So I have a whole chapter in the book about caring for yourself. And what are some of the ways you guys are doing that now? Anybody want to share what they're doing to care for themselves?
Exercise.
Perfect. And we know that that's the number one way to stave off dementia. You perfuse that brain with a lot of blood and oxygen. Double benefits, right? Release the endorphins, stave off dementia, and maybe you can keep your sense of balance when you get home, right? What else can we do? Do crossword puzzles, something sort of quiet and meditative. I think being outside is really helpful to people, even if it's just going for a walk. You can do things that cost money, but honestly, just sometimes getting out of Dodge and going for a walk can just help you. And I like to take my dad for a walk. And if people are in a wheelchair, you can bundle them up. Jewish Home, if you go there, in that freezing cold out there on Silver Avenue, they have all of the skilled nursing residents bundled up head to toe, but they're out there in their reclining wheelchairs for 20 minutes every day, and they love it. Learning to manage your expectations. I do a lot of this work with clients. I help them understand what their parents may be going through and what other children are going through that I've heard over the years. And I want to read, I think that when our parent gets a diagnosis and I'll say, have you done any reading about this? Do you know about the resources? Inevitably, the person has dealt with this for a year or two and done nothing. It's like you get a kitten and you don't read anything about how to care for a kitten. Well, you just buy it food and good luck with that. And no dog training classes. Like, we do so much for every other thing we're taking care of, but not when it comes to our parents. We just assume it's off the cuff. So I was reading Scientific America had the Caregiver's Dilemma. I don't know if you saw this issue, but I loved what they said. They had top tips for caregivers. Learn as much as possible about the disorder you are dealing with. The more you know about typical symptoms and behaviors, the better you can anticipate problems and not take them personally, all of which helps to build a sense of competence and control. I thought that was brilliant. I talk to families a lot about avoiding learned helplessness. Does anybody know what that is? Have you heard that term? So it's a term we use in gerontology, which is the idea that you're doing something for someone who can do for themselves a certain activity, and they then learn to be helpless. We see it a lot in institutions. So when I had my daughter who was 3, I had to tie her shoes because, oh, she doesn't know how to tie her shoes. She's 25, I'm no longer tying her shoes. But what happens in an institution is, the person dresses the person, and that person can start to dress themselves, but nobody thinks to ask them or put it upon them. They just continue doing the task. It's faster. It's easier. It's going to be more appropriate clothing, whatever they tell themselves, and they don't stop to say, wait, her hip is a lot better. Put your own shoes on. Tie your own shoes. We don't often check in with the population to say, you know, Dad, do you think you can still do this on your own? If so, good, I'm not going to. And you want to back off whatever you don't need to do so that you're not putting them into learned helplessness. Waiting for windows of time of discussion. My best friend told me that that was the best thing I ever told her. She had a mother in San Francisco in an apartment, in her home that had stairs. And my friend was really trying to get her ducks lined up in a row in advance. And she would talk to her mother about relocating to the East Bay where she was. She was talk with her about getting Lifeline. And mother said, no, 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 no. And she'd come to me and I said, there will be a crisis. There will be a time when things will switch and your mother will be open to this information. And you could just see her shoulders go down, that it was no longer all on her to keep pushing this rock up the hill, that she could just relax into knowing that it all may fall apart, and that may be your window to have that discussion to bring in those resources, and that still makes you a good daughter. And indeed, that's what happened, and her mother now lives in assisted living. She's 93, happy as a clam, and her daughter's 15 minutes away. But it took that crisis pivotal point. So have those conversations when the windows are open and don't bang your head against the wall if your parent is saying, I call it being the dog at the vet, you know? They're just doing this on the linoleum and you're pulling them along. You can also use an elder care manager. Someone like myself is available nationwide. There is a website called aginglifemanager.org, and you can type in the zip code of your loved one and find an elder care manager who can come out and have the conversations with your parent that you may not be having effectively. And we have a lot of purchase because we are not the adult child. So we can make things happen that you cannot. I talked about doing one errand a day, one errand per outing. So CVS is right near your mom's bank. My advice to you is to go to CVS, do your shopping, pick up the medications, and go home, and don't go to the bank. It's not green, it's not efficient, but it will save your sense of humor, it will keep your temper. You want to do just one errand per day. If your person is particularly spry and up for it, great, but honestly, just doing one errand per day gets you back home both in a much better mood. And just go to the bank the next day and get drive-through or something. Make your life a little bit easier. Don't try and knock out all of the things at once. And train your loved one. We train them. I was thinking earlier, because I show up every day and ask my dad, how are things going? I've trained him to expect me to come every day, right? So we have to say what we can do, and we have to think about what we can do for the long haul. If you can go grocery shopping for your parent every Saturday, say, Dad, Mom, I love you. I can come every Saturday and give you 3 hours of my time. We can go to the ballet. We can go grocery shopping. This is what I can do, and then here are the things we're going to have to pay for. And there's a whole chapter in the book about hiring paid help because that's a sticky wicket, but it can be done, and it's a good idea to not have everything on us, especially because this is not a sprint, it's a marathon. So if you are doing this caregiving for 5, 10 more years, you have to pace yourself and make sure that it works with your schedule. And things are going to ebb and flow in your own life, right? So you're going to have them go with it. But I can't tell you, you know, my dad would call and say, you know, I'm out of Jell-O. And I'm thinking, I have to leave work and go get Jell-O. Or somehow I'm like, oh, okay, that's on my list to do after work. And then I'm like, he's not going to die if I don't bring him Jell-O. What is the matter with me? Dad, I'm going shopping on Saturday. I will get you Jell-O then. Okay. But initially I thought, oh, I better do this. I'm the dutiful daughter and he's out of Jell-O. But you have to stop and realize they're not going to die without Jell-O or shampoo or whatever the heck they're asking you for. And what I ended up realizing with my dad is that it was his code for being lonely and wanting companionship. He wasn't able to say, I'm lonely, can you come over and hang out? He would say, I need Jell-O, and then I would come over. Or he couldn't find something and I'd drive over. So I realized over time, maybe he's just feeling a little lonely and maybe I need to have a more social time with him. Keeping your sense of humor. I think knowing that we're not alone in all of this is key. And I put up two good websites, lotsofhelpinghands.com and caringbridge.com. It's a place to talk about what's going on. A lot of caregivers are not on their computers until about midnight, statistically, even if they have, especially if they have a relative with dementia, because that's when it's finally their time. That person is cared for, put to bed, fed, dishes are away, and now it's their time. So they have online support groups, and they'll write what a day they had, and then the East Coast would answer, and they would wake up and be able to see that they had sort of a commiserative kind of relationship, and they loved it, and you felt supported. So I think that helps keep your sense of humor a lot, being in sort of a group setting and knowing you can laugh at some of this and that it's not all what's going on in your house. I think these support groups are also good because when you talk to somebody at the gym about their mom or about your mom, what I've noticed is that someone will try and outbid you on what their parent is doing and how much worse it is at their house. And you don't feel particularly heard. You don't feel particularly supported. It becomes more of a, oh, well, your cat died. Well, it's like you don't really get to vent. So these online groups are great. You can just vent to your heart's content. Somebody can respond or not, but you get it off your chest. I think dark humor goes a long way in gerontology. We have a lot of dark humor. One of the stories, a woman I cared for in San Francisco moved to L.A. to be near her daughter, and they went into a small board and care home, and her daughter said, "Guess what my mom said to me today? I don't know whether to laugh or cry." I said, "What?" She said, "How did you find me, dear?" And she's like, "How do you even answer that? Like, it was so sad. Like, does she think I don't know how to drive here? Do they think that..." She just was like, and I just thought, I thought that was kind of funny. Every time she came after that, "How did you find me? How did you find me, dear?" It's like, "I don't know, Mom. I'm just really resourceful. I'm your daughter, and I'm glad to see you." And but it's dark, you know? There's a lot of heartbreak in all of this, too. I was thinking one of the things to tell you, too, is to be flexible, because things are going to change all the time. You're going to go to the ER so many times. You know, you're never going to get all of this right, but you're going to do the darn best that you can. And it's okay to try and roll with the punches, but it's okay to also to take a vacation, to say no, to say I can't. When my dad was dying, I didn't want to be at the bedside. I had decided I had had enough, and I kind of reached this place where it was really uncomfortable. And my sister, who doesn't come down very much, came down from Idaho and said, "Well, Dad's not going to die alone." Drove her butt down here and stayed with him on his bedside for 3 weeks. And it was like a spring chicken, right? 3 weeks where she hadn't done anything. I'd done it for the last 2 years. She was the perfect person to be with her. And I got to step out and have some respite. And I don't have any regrets. What I wanted to say, too, is that this last thing, someday you may wish they were around. I have been told the most lovely stories by people who are doing caregiving that have told me things that came out of doing that caregiving and that concentrated time with their parent that would have never happened had they not been there to wipe their tears, wipe their butt, help them to the bathroom, get them to the doctor. I had a woman who was taking care of her father. He was 92, came to her house. She had been caring for him on and off and driving back and forth for a long, long time. And then she brought him home to her home to pass in hospice. And she said, "Do you know, a week before he died, he told me he loved me, and it was the first time." And I get chills still telling that story. I'm like, all that you did and all this FaceTime you had with him and all the years. She said, you know, and I 92, the first time. So these amazing things can come out of this journey. I don't think caregiving is very easy to do, but I want you to know that I think some wonderful things can come out of it. And coming to a group like this can help you keep your sense of humor and lighten your load too. I want to show you some fun gadgets that I have, and I'll end on that. I don't know. What I like to talk about is getting in and out of a car, because that's getting a little bit... I see people in the Safeway parking lot all the time trying to help mom or dad in and out of the car, and mobility in and out of a car stinks. If you have back pain, hip pain, etc. So I want to show you some cool stuff I've found. This is called the Handy Bar, and my mother loves this because she had to get knee replacement, but you put this silver nozzle metal into the striker plate on the car. I think that's what they call it. There's like a little notch. You'll see it when you get to the car. They all have it. And this fits in there. And then you can press down to get yourself out of the car. And it's easier for people to use their body with their upper arms. You'll see a lot of assisted living homes have arms on the chair. That's because it's easier to help yourself up by pushing down. And that's what this provides. These are $35. You can get them online. I even brought a couple tonight to sell. I don't make any commission or anything, but I just thought in case make life easier for you. This is one of my favorites. It's called a swivel seat, but I call it a lazy Susan for your butt. It swivels, And it's padded, and it holds up to 350 pounds. And I'm away from the mic, so sorry about the sound quality, but I want to show you how this works. What I see is that you try and get your mom or dad to sit in the car, but the movement to put their paws, legs facing this way before she can close the door is tough. Pretty cool. So if you have mobility issues, back hurts, leg hurt, whatever, this is really helpful for people to get in and out of a car. I ran into a chiropractor. I don't know if I have a picture of this. I don't. Who told me that he took his mom to the doctor's and he ripped her pants because he was holding on to her at the top of her pants. He says, I gave her a wedgie and then I ripped her pants trying to get her into the car. So he invented transfer pants, and I want to show you what this looks like. They have built into the pants handles so that you can hold on to your loved one front or back, side to side, and help them get in and out of a car. You're not holding on to the top of the pant, and he's reinforced it so that you don't get the wedgie. It comes in fleece and twill and blue jean, and he makes a pair of shorts for when you're bathing the person if you want to help get them in and out of the shower. So this is a brand new product. I think it's pretty cool so that you can kind of get a hold on somebody, especially if they're slippery in the shower and you're trying to help them in and out of the shower. Lastly, I like to add a little light on the subject. So I like these lights. This is just one. I think I got it from TV. It's called Light Angel. Maybe I was up late with HSN. I don't know. And the idea is that you can mount this with screws or with tape and then swivel it. And what I use this for is putting it at the baseboard when someone's going to get out of bed to illuminate the pathway, because most people rely on their bathroom nightlight to get them from their bedside to the bathroom. And I've had clients trip over their dog, trip over their slippers. So now I just make sure that when I come, I can just sit it there and the lights go on. I don't think it's going to work because it's too light. But it's pretty bright. And I use this at my front door to aim it at the key so that if the lights aren't on outside at night, this will go on with motion and I can put the key in the lock. $15. So again, this helps prevent falls. See? That's it. You did good. I hope you learned some stuff. And I'm happy to take your questions. And I want to remind you that I'm available to do 90-minute family consultations. I do them as conference calls, usually with people if they're in different places. I also speak. I can speak to employees where you work. I can speak to your coworkers if you want to have me in, or different civic groups. And obviously, I'll be at Rhoda Goldman on the 11th of December. So thank you so much for your attention. I hope this was helpful. Oh, we have the raffle.
Are we doing a raffle?
We are doing a raffle. Thank you. Is that all right to do the raffle before the questions?
It's your program.
Okay. Great. We're going to raffle off 2 copies of the book, and then Sarah is selling them. I find when people buy one, they usually like to buy another one for someone they know who's going through something similar. So we sell them 2 for $20, or you can just buy 1 for $12.95, but I'm happy to give away 2 copies, and of course I'll sign them if you want. Let's see here.
No collusion.
Yeah. Oh, I guess this card's in the
back. Oh, are they? Well,
thank you. You want to read that for me?
Oh,
there you
go.
So you're so welcome.
I didn't win. 491-8960.
Oh,
Sure, no, okay. Yes, okay, thank you.
All right. Thank you. Our thanks to Kira Reginato, our speaker tonight. Please join me in thanking her for her comments. I am John Milford, chairs of the Grownups Forum, and will be moderating today's question and answer period. And I know there are questions, so if you have one, please put your hand up, and we have a mic that will come to you. And Kira, come on up.
Hi, Kira. My name is Quinn. I'm not a caregiver at the moment. I did spend a few months with my grandfather when he was towards the end of his life, and that was fascinating and terrifying all at once. My mother is approaching that age, or is in that age, and like her mother before her, starting to experience some various names for it, and the diagnosis isn't so important, but dementia-type characteristics. And so I'm actually here just on behalf of my sister and I, really just ask one question, because we've looked for it in other forums and books and haven't been able to quite get a fix on this specific question about how to deal with dementia or Alzheimer's type characteristics. And that centers around how much it's important that they acknowledge what's happening. Because one of the things that we observed, and it's sort of strange to have watched our mother go through this with her mother and now see her going through almost the same experience, and yet she's, even though she's a psychologist herself, reacting not as somebody who's gone through this, but reacting to somebody who is going through it. And the previous experience seems to have not quite had an effect that as maybe we would have expected it to.
It's a great question, Quinn.
Yeah.
Let me start by, I have an answer, by the way.
Okay.
Let me start by asking you, if you were in her shoes, what would you want to know?
So I have a slight bit of very, very mild experience with this.
Oh, I thought you were going to say a slight bit of dementia already that you are copping to.
Kind of, actually. Okay. I got a bad concussion once.
Okay, okay, then TBI would do it. Okay.
And it was short-term effects.
Okay.
Relatively, but one of the experiences that delivered was that my short-term memory was, or my memory for a temporary period was shot.
Yep.
That was strange and unexpected. I wasn't in round-the-clock care or any sort of... We didn't really know what was going on, but it became very apparent quickly. And my significant other at the time and family had to sort of deal with the fact that I was a little nuts for some period of time. And one of the things that taught me was that for a while, of course, there's a bit of denial. No, 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 I'm fine. And then eventually I came around to, oh, yeah, this is happening. And that acknowledgement, and that by leaning into the acknowledgement, going, oh yeah, no, I'm just crazy right now, was like, oh, you tell me that we already talked about this. You're probably right because I'm not.
So,
and I know that that's so much easier because it was temporary and I could have that as a crutch. And it was so much easier emotionally for me than it would have been for anybody at the end of their life. But,
and it sounds though also like you had a little bit of what you and I would call insight into the fact that you'd had this traumatic brain injury and that you might not be operating correctly.
It was really identifiable because there was a specific event. Like, I understand all the reasons why it was easier for me.
So,
the question is then, is it important to transfer that kind of experience, or is it possible?
I would say that it is not necessary at all, and that's where I see the people banging their head against the wall all the time because they're still using logic and waiting for buy-in. And I would tell you that regardless of what the factors are that we know academically, psychically, you know, but if you knew that you had something that was going to destroy your brain over time, the same way that you knew dead to rights happened to another person, that's its own kettle of fish, let alone the organic pathology that's changing the brain to be able to hold on and use that kind of thought. And it's very hard to self-soothe, and or what I usually see is that people don't even have insight into the fact that this is going on. So you're using that this is a smart woman. She should be able to understand what we're saying, and using that logical argument, I counsel families all the time, do not do that. It doesn't serve anybody. It's frustrating for you, and it doesn't affect change for them. So I would say that it's not important at all to get her on that page at all. I would take my cue from her with where she is, and I would start driving the boat so it doesn't go into the iceberg. Because what I see happen is that because she was smart, people want her to still be the captain of her ship, and then the whole place goes down around her because nobody wants to power up and say, I think you need to go below deck and get some sleep, Captain. I'm going to take over from here and right the ship. Nobody wants to do that. This is a smart, capable person in their lives, and we're like, how do I negotiate this new rule? What I'm telling you is you got to power up. You got to do what's best for the whole situation. You got to get support for what that looks like. And I don't mean to be dictatorial about it, but you have to intellectually make that switch that you are now the captain, you are now driving that boat, and they really don't get the same say-so that they've had for the last years.
Quick follow-up to that. So my concern is not so much with taking control or ownership or leadership, is more about how you counter fallacies.
You don't. That's what I'm telling you.
Okay.
You do not.
So nope. If they say, I don't remember you doing that, or that's not true, we never talked about that.
I'm really sorry. Do you want me to go over it again? Didn't say you'd be here at 10 o'clock for the doctor's appointment, didn't I? I'm really sorry. Are you ready to go? Do you want me to help you get ready?
Take one.
You're always wrong.
Gotcha.
You're always the bad guy because there's no way, whether it's intellectually that they can't accept the blame or whether it's just too damn painful to think I'm losing it so much that even though I wrote it on the calendar and I have 62 post-it notes that say Quinn will be here at 10, Quinn will be here at 10, I can't encode what the hell that's saying, and I wasn't ready. I'm in my PJs. I'm embarrassed. I don't have it together. So what you say is, oh, I see you're not ready to go yet. Well, we're not going today. I looked at my calendar and it is today. Do you want me to reschedule or do you want to get dressed? I'll tell them we're running a little bit late. Well, this is just ridiculous. We don't have an appointment. I think we do. Do you mind if I help you get into your shoes and I'll pull the car around? Like, you are always the wrong one. You never, ever push back and go into that. It doesn't get you anywhere. So you, yeah. And you screw up a lot, frankly. All the time. Is that helpful?
Very helpful.
Good. Yeah.
It's for the tape.
Really? Okay. My sister-in-law is a caregiver for my mother-in-law, and they share a house together, and they're basically together 24/7. And because of that, their moods, they're not always happy, and they get at each other's throats. Mm-hmm. Is there anything they can do to ameliorate their lives, to make them a little more livable, so they can get along better under those circumstances?
I will tell you, Americans don't tend to live in 2- and 3-generation households anymore. So what I have seen is that people don't do it well because they're not well practiced in it. So that's the first thing I tell families is if you haven't lived with your parent historically or had grandma and you, and don't do it when you get older because it only works for about 6 months during the honeymoon and then it falls to crap. And I have to pick up the pieces because they call and said, I told my mom to sell her house, move in, and I'd take care of her. So what I usually try to do in that situation is set up some roommate rules, if you will, because you've started off thinking because we love each other, this is going to work. It's how every marriage starts, right? It's just we think it's automatic, but it's not. So you need to go back to limits and boundaries. Mom, when I'm in the living room, I like to come home after work and have a drink and not have you even ask me how my day was. It's not that I don't love you, but from 5 to 7, I want to watch Jeopardy and eat Cheetos and have, you know, and I don't want to talk to you. I don't want to talk to anybody, so don't take it personally. So setting up some new roommate rules. I'd like to use the kitchen at this time. You're welcome to use that because 24/7 is too much for both of us. I often suggest people get into activity programs so that they're off campus. They're in an adult day health program. They're doing Tai Chi. They're going somewhere. And I will work to get that transportation going, whether it's paratransit or regular transit. And I will get that person physically out of the house as many hours as they can tolerate and that they can afford. Because that mimics real life. Because if your sister-in-law is home all the time and the mother-in-law is home all the time, that doesn't mimic real life. We're not around each other 24 hours a day. The caregiver that you hire would be able to administer food into that feeding tube, or you keep the visits in between feeding times. You have to get creative, but it's important that they get some alone time, and you just have to negotiate that within the house like roommates.
Kira, our time is almost gone, but we have time for one more question.
Okay.
And then if others have questions, will you stay? And
happy to stay. Sure.
Okay, good.
Thank you.
We have time for one more.
Yeah, I was going to follow along with Quinn's questions because it's a similar situation. But so I have a mother in the same kind of situation, maybe farther advanced, and doesn't acknowledge the decline. And does things like, oh, I'm going to move to Nebraska. And she keeps talking about things that she's going to do that she clearly can't do. So, yes, I'm, you know, willing to have it all my fault. But, and you've really helped with this idea of one errand a day. That's very good. But she keeps thinking that she can do more than she can do.
And the thing is, I see this a lot. And I've actually had people move their mom back to Nebraska because the person said, I want to go home. I've come to realize that that ideation is really, I want to go back to a time when this worked. And that for me was this house. And I've had people move their mom back to there. Guess what the mom says? I want to go home. And the kids are like, you've got to be kidding me. We just moved you back to Akron. I'll kill you. I'll kill you. I mean, just they go completely. And I'm like, it's because it's not the building. It's not the town. It's where their mind was organized. So what I say is, let them dream. Let them think. Let them say that. They aren't going to do it. They're not going to get in an Uber and go to Nebraska, right? I mean, some of my clients do foxy things, but if your mom is at the point where she's just having that ideation, usually what I'll say is, what did you like about Nebraska? Tell me about it, Mom. I remember visiting there once with you. Didn't Aunt Linda live? Do Nebraska with her for a while. Go on that trip with her mentally. Go down memory lane because that's going to soothe her soul more than actually packing some bags and relocating. Thanks, everybody, for being here tonight. I hope this was helpful.
Thank you, Kira. We also thank our audience here as well as those listening to the recording. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 114th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.